introduction and for the invitation to talk about this, and also, I guess, for, you know, putting together this conference, which has been very nice, and lots of interactions with many people, no pun intended, strong interactions, all that. Anyway. All right, so this is work in collaboration with Richard, Luca, and Sean, who are all at this conference. And you can find it on the archive. And also, I'm grateful to the European Union for supporting my research. Normally, I mean, I'm more of a holographer. And, you know, this ADS-CMT program has been going on for now a few years. But I guess at some point, like, if you want to learn exactly what you should do with all these black holes, then it's good to do a little bit of condensed matter. But condensed matter is hard, so you need some entry points. And I guess, all right, this is my entry point. So, applying like effective field theory techniques and hydrodynamics to condensed matter problems, because these are typically tools that we high energy theorists are more comfortable with than, say, summing a whole truckload of diagrams to computer conductivity. Like, you know, more direct approaches to computing error conductivities. So there was a lot of work recently on momentum relaxation, so that's why I wanted to briefly mention it at the beginning of the talk, also because it gives you a nice introduction to what I actually want to talk about. So if you have a conserved quantity, say momentum, that overlaps with another operator, say the electrical current, then the electric conductivity at zero frequency will diverge. And for instance, we've seen already this formula a couple of times at the conference. In relativistic hydrodynamics, you see the appearance of this 1 over omega pole in the imaginary part. So that translates into a delta function in the real part. And this is simply telling you that because the electrical current overlaps with the momentum current, whenever there's a momentum flow, there will also be an electric current flow. And if momentum is not relaxed, then the electrical current cannot relax either. There's also this sigma q piece that we've heard a little bit about, and this is related to the diffusive degrees of freedom of the system. And in particular, it doesn't overlap with momentum, so that's why it's finite. If momentum is slowly relaxed, on the other hand, then instead of having a divergence at zero frequency, then you will broaden out this delta function into what is typically referred to as a Joule peak. And this will have it with gamma, which appears, so you see that this pole, which was at omega equals zero, has been shifted down the lower axis. It's still purely imaginary. It's sitting at minus I omega. And if gamma is much less than t, then this peak will be rather sharp. And there's been a lot of work recently in gauge gravity duality and hydrodynamics to model this. So inspired by this, we're going to look at a different system, which also has some delta function in the conductivity. And we'll see in what way it makes sense to relax this other delta function. So namely, I want to think about superfluids, where there's a U1 symmetry which is spontaneously broken. And this happens because some complex order parameter condenses. And the phase, so the amplitude of the complex scalar gets a VeV, and its phase becomes the Gaussian boson of the spontaneously broken U1 symmetry. And by gauge invariance, we've heard that a few times over the week, and again yesterday, by gauge invariance, you can relate the time derivative of the phase to the chemical potential. So now, if you take a spatial derivative, you'll define what is referred to as a superfluid velocity, introducing some Mascal M. So what this formula says is that if I have a phase gradient, then I will source an electric field. And so in particular, this conserved superfluid current couples to the electrical current. And if the superfluid current is not relaxing, then there will be a delta function in the electrical conductivity. And this is precisely what we see. And now there's a new coefficient that appears, the superfluid density. So yeah, it's basically the same idea as for momentum relaxation. But I want to now forget about momentum relaxation. I want to talk about superfluid phase relaxation. So first, what I need to do is tell you why that's interesting. So if you look at thin two-dimensional superfluid films, say like indium oxide, then what people measured very early on is that if you cranked up the disorder of all the magnetic fields, then you would induce a phase transition between the superfluid phase and an insulating phase. And this is what these plots are showing. They're showing you plots of the resistivity versus temperature when you vary disorder or when you vary the magnetic field. And you see that in this region, at low temperatures, the resistivity is diverging. So this is the insulating phase. The resistivity goes to zero. So this is the superfluid phase. And on the other hand, here, the resistivity diverges. And this is the insulating phase. And you can understand the physics behind it just by remembering that magnetic fields tend to destroy superconductivity. So you would expect that if you crank up the magnetic field, you'll have a phase transition. And in the same way, disorder tends to localize degrees of freedom. So again, instead of having a superfluid, it's not unreasonable to expect an insulator. And in these 2D superfluid films, you get even something better, because there's a quantum critical point that sits at this phase transition. And you can get a hint, an experimental hint, that this is happening by realizing that all these experimental curves collapse nicely. And so there's a quantum critical point sitting here. And moreover, it takes this universal value, h over 4e squared, and then Fisher in the 90s constructed a whole scaling theory of that to explain exactly how things were behaving. So all of this physics is very nicely accounted for. And then you have this sort of phase diagram. So let me not talk too much about this, but let's look at these two axes. This is temperature, this is disorder. So in this plane, you have, you know, the usual superconducting physics that you expect. There's a high temperature metallic phase, then you lower the temperature, the order parameter condenses, and you end up in a superconducting phase. But now let's look at what happens when you crank up the magnetic fields. At first, you have this vortex lattice, because the magnetic field starts piercing the sample. But the vortices are pinned, so they're not moving. And then if you crank up the magnetic field high enough, then you enter this insulating phase. There was a surprise a little bit later on, when people started looking at less disordered films, so still disordered, but less disordered. And then they measured, so it's work by Kapitulnik and collaborators, they measured that the curves didn't really collapse up to extremely low temperatures. And so what this means is that you're not having a transition directly from a superconductor to an insulator. There's some intervening metallic phase, because at zero temperature, it looks like the resistivity wants to stay finite, neither zero nor diverging. And the question is, how do you understand that? And in particular, what this means is that now you have to modify this phase diagram to account for some putative intermediate metallic phase. And that's a big problem in condensed matter, because normally bosons, they're really only supposed to be doing two things at low temperatures, either condense or localize, but not be metallic. Now, if you turn to optical conductivity measurements to try and understand a little bit better what's going on, then what you see in this part of phase diagram, where you see this finite resistivity at low temperatures, you see that first, the optical conductivity as a function of frequency displays very sharp peaks. And the width of these peaks gets higher. I mean, you see here that, yeah, it's pretty sharp for various values of the magnetic field. And of course, I mean, if you crank the magnetic field high enough, then you exit the metallic phase, so the peak totally disappears, and you have this very flat conductivity. And on the other end, if you look at the imaginary conductivity, then you see that at low magnetic fields, you still have a 1 over omega pole. So these are the straight lines. But as you crank up the magnetic field and enter the metallic phase, then this omega, you don't have this 1 over omega behavior, and the omega equals 0 pole is resolved. So you really no longer have a superfluid delta function. If you then measure the width of these peaks, and you plot it as a function of magnetic field, then you get these points. So again, it's the same thing. So here is the magnetic field. Here is the energy scale. So at low magnetic fields, you are in a superfluid phase. And then you crank up the magnetic field, and you see that there's a peak that develops. The width of which is given by this curve. But basically, what you notice is that at this particular value of the magnetic field, the width of the peak vanishes. So these people, Armitage and collaborators, conjecture that maybe there's a quantum critical point also sitting there, because there's an energy scale that vanishes. And as a last motivation to look at these phase fluctuations that will resolve the delta function, I wanted to mention these measurements on one of the cuprates, where this is basically the phase diagram, where you have the superconducting dome, but then these people measured that these superfluid phase fluctuations were also important in this region right here. So these are also important for the physics in, say, the cuprates, not just two-dimensional superfluid films.
What is the plot area?
What is, so this is temperature, this is doping. Here they're plotting the temperature at which they see that the omega equals zero pole is being resolved.
Optical conductivity
measurements. The exact same types of measurement as these ones. All right, so now the plan of the talk will be to construct a theory of superfluid hydrodynamics, which includes weak phase relaxation. And then we're going to test our superfluid hydro by comparing it to a memory matrix treatment, where this is exact. There's a priori no hydro approximation in the memory matrix calculation. And the memory matrix calculation will do something more. It will also give us a formula for the width of that peak. And we'll start by restricting to parity invariant setups, so no magnetic field, and then we'll move on to parity violating setups. So as we've heard a number of times, hydro is universal long wavelength description, small frequency description of the dynamics of the system. And what you do is that you truncate the degrees of freedom that you're keeping track of. You only keep conserved quantities and broken symmetry Goldstone modes. The rest all decay very fast, so they're not part of the late time long wavelength description. And moreover, since we're really motivated by films that are rather disordered, we'll assume that momentum relaxes quickly, and so we will integrate it out of our hydro. So this is not, momentum density is not going to be part of the hydro variables. We do include the phase of the order parameter, so the Goldstone mode, and so by gauge invariance, it is given by this Josephson relation, phi dot equals minus mu. And this will get corrected at high order in derivatives. So you should think of that as a constitutive relation for the phase of the complex scalar.
I'm sorry, I'm just really confused by something you're saying. So isn't the point of the superfluid that the phase doesn't relax, that it's incompressible?
What these measurements are telling you is that you're in a phase where the order parameter has condensed. So electrons have paired together, the amplitude has a VeV, but the phase is still fluctuating. I'll have more to say about that.
There's two
distinguished temperatures in the system. There's the mean field temperature where the order parameter condenses, and then there's the, well, just to anticipate a little bit, there's the BKT temperature where the superfluid phase becomes globally coherent through the sample. Give me a couple slides and maybe things will become a bit clearer.
I wouldn't use the word autoparameter condensing. Maybe you could say locally condensed. I wouldn't say it's condensed. Autoparameter includes the phase.
Yes. It get, well, the electrons pair up. There's a condensate.
Local condensate.
Okay, good enough. So since we've integrated at momentum, the set of hydro variables we're going to be working with are the energy density, the charge density, and the superfluid velocity. And the equations of motion will simply be the conservation of energy and charge. So then what we need to do is give constitutive relations for all these variables. And so what we'll do is expand the electrical current and the heat current and the superfluid velocity in derivatives. And at first order, we only have a few coefficients that describe the response of the system to gradients of chemical potential, gradients of temperature, and gradients of the superfluid velocity. So then you turn the crank, you use Kadanoff and Martin, and you get the hydrodynamic form for the thermoelectric conductivities. And so note that there's this delta function, the superfluid delta function. For now, the phase is still conserved. But note as well that the superfluid delta function doesn't appear in the other conductivities. So that's another way to say that a supercurrent drags electricity but not heat. So the heat conductivity is finite. At this stage, the collective excitation, since we've heard a little bit about that, I thought I should say a couple words. So since we've integrated out momentum, we don't have the pair of acoustic momentum-related sound modes. We don't have the pressure waves. We have the superfluid second sound mode, so it's these two blue dots. And then there's a thermal diffusion mode right here on the lower imaginary axis. Keep that in mind, because I'll tell you in a little while what happens once the superfluid phase is relaxing. So in two dimensions, it's well known that you need to care about vortex physics. So I've put this nice picture of vortices. It's the vortices of a gas of electrons, so it's not really exactly the same thing that I want to tell you about, but still I thought the picture was nice. So what happens is that at finite temperature, vortices can be pair created and proliferate if you're above a certain transition temperature. And once these vortices proliferate and start to move, they will destroy superfluidity. I'll tell you how that happens. Let me just point out for now, as we've again heard a little bit before, at a vortex, what happens is that the amplitude of the order parameter vanishes, and so the phase is not defined. So the phase will be defined everywhere in the sample except at the location of a vortex. So what this means, you know, it's the same thing as polar coordinates in a plane. So at exactly r equals 0, the angular coordinate is not defined, and so you have to give it a periodicity. So here we're doing the same thing. At the location of a vortex, if you circulate the superfluid velocity around it, then you have to quantize it. So that's this n, the winding number. And what this means is that the superfluid phase that used to be a pure gradient, the superfluid velocity that used to be a pure gradient, well, that's still true, but away from vortices. At a vortex, the superfluid velocity has a non-gradient part, there's a rotational part. So typically, vortices are nucleated in pairs of vortices and anti-vortices. And since we're in disordered films, they're typically pinned at impurity or lattice sites. So if the temperature is not high enough, then these vortices, they just stay pinned. They don't have enough energy to actually start moving. And if they stay pinned, then the phase will wind around like a pair of vortex and anti-vortex, and so globally there won't be any loss of phase coherence, and you'll still be superfluid. So that's why when you start turning on a magnetic field, you're still in a superconducting phase. It has to be a bit higher in order for superfluidity, superconductivity to be destroyed. But on the other hand, so that's what I'm plotting here, mobile vortices will relax the supercurrents, right? If they're like moving apart from each other, then there's this line that stretches where these lines mean that the phase is winding by 2 pi each time. So as soon as there's a vortex flow, as soon as the temperature is high enough so that the vortex can actually unpin, then the phase, the superfluid phase, will no longer globally coherent, and superfluidity will be destroyed. So that's the essence of BKT physics. So what you then expect is, since this inside the core, you don't have a superfluid, you have a normal fluid, then normal fluids, when they move, produce dissipation. So you expect that once the vortices start to move, then again, dissipation will be produced and superfluidity will be destroyed. It's another way to say the same thing. And in particular, what you expect is that now the form of the electrical conductivity should be modified in this way. So that is, instead of having a pole at omega equals 0, you expect this delta function to acquire a finite width, and you'll parameterize that by this capital omega. And there's an old classical calculation, and I was definitely not born then, where Bardeen and Stephen computed the width of that peak in terms of the density of free vortices, so the density of vortices that are moving around in the sample, and the normal conductivity, the conductivity of the normal fluid inside the core. And this is, again, not unreasonable, since, you know, what produces dissipation is the normal fluid inside the cores. I'm putting squiggles. I mean, they have actual numbers, and these numbers will matter later on, but for now, let me just put squiggles. So we need to take into account vortices in our hydro, and we do that by defining a vortex density, and that's the usual formula for it. So it's the curl of the superfluid velocity. And what this means is that there's a conserved vortex current, because locally vortices, the vortex density is conserved. And this is consistent with a modified Josephson relation, where now we've turned on this term, which is proportional to the transverse vortex current. the interpretation of that is that, say that you're static, then a vortex flow will induce a transverse voltage. That's what this term means. So now we need to give this vortex current a constitutive relation. So you write terms that are allowed by symmetries at zeroth order, first order in derivatives, etc. And the important term for us is this one. So this is some sort of Magnus force that's felt by the vortices. So if you go back to this Bardeen and Steven paper, that's exactly what they're encoding. They're writing force equations, and they're balancing the forces together. And there's a dissipative force, and there's a Magnus force, and this is how they're getting out this width. There's a diffusion part that, honestly, I don't care too much about. So we don't really have, I don't really want to talk about it. It doesn't really play a big role in what I have to say, but it's there for consistency. You can use positivity of the divergence of the entropy current, and then you'll see that omega has to be positive, and it contributes to the right-hand side of the divergence of the entropy current, so it produces dissipation in the system. And it breaks the conservation of the phase, because now I can, you know, plug this back in the Josephson relation, and I remember that U phi has both a potential part and a rotational part, so I can project along this part. And when I project along phi, then I find this effective equation. So this term omega is doing exactly what we want it to do. It's relaxing the value of the superfluid phase. And now you go again, and you use Kadanoff-Martin, and you recompute your thermoelectric conductivities, and you find that, indeed, the electrical conductivity has there's no longer a delta function, no longer a superfluid delta function. So now let me turn to the spectrum. So we have this new version of hydro. You remember, if the superfluid phase didn't relax, then I had a thermal diffusion pole, so this guy, and a pair of superfluid sound modes. So now we can look at various regime as we're turning on this relaxation of the phase. So at very small relaxation of the phase, small compared to the wave vector, then the only thing that happens is that the superfluid sound modes are slightly lifted, they get a small mass. So qualitatively, the picture is still looking a bit like that. But then as you crank up omega, there's going to be a critical, so these poles start to move along the along some parabola in the lower half plane, and at some critical value, they'll meet on the imaginary axis, collide, and if you continue cranking up omega, then they'll produce only purely imaginary poles. One is the Judah type pole, so this guy. And this one is proportional to omega, so that's why it's going down. If you crank up the value of omega, then this pole is going down the imaginary axis, and the peak is getting broader and broader in the electrical conductivity. But then there's another pole, which is a pseudo-diffusive pole with a diffusion constant that's proportional to 1 over omega. So that's what the spectrum looks like in this relaxed theory. Okay, so we've constructed this superfluid theory, and we did it, you know, using guiding principles and symmetries and derivatives. But it would be nice to, you know, check that we actually did things correctly. And a nice formalism to do that is the memory matrix. And I won't tell you too much about how that works. But basically, you just look at operators, and you think about the overlap between various operators, and that allows you to write a very complicated formula for the conductivity in terms of all the operators that the electrical current overlaps with. So in itself, that's not an extremely useful way, because you can't really do anything with this complicated formula. But then what you'll do is that you'll assume that your original Hamiltonian is deformed by some Hamiltonian deformation that is relaxing one of your conserved operators, one of your long-lived operators. And that will allow you to truncate this formula to a much simpler formula, where you will only have to keep track of a small number of operators. Basically, the operators that have non-zero overlap with this slowly decaying one. So that's a very useful thing. So to be a little bit more precise, we want to think about the decay of the superfluid current operator. This is the operator that we're interested in. So we want to turn on some deformation of the Hamiltonian that will not commute with J phi. And here the definition of J phi is that it's the spatial integral of the superfluid phase over your whole sample minus the vortex cores, where the superfluid phase is not defined. And this set of techniques, so it's not anything very new, but it's proven very useful more recently to, you know, treat momentum relaxation in a consistent way. So in our case, these slow operators that we're keeping in our memory matrix are the electrical current, the superfluid current, and the heat current. And what we find at the end of the day is we use this complicated formula, we truncate it, we evaluate a bunch of static susceptibilities, et cetera. Let me not go into all of these details. But at the end of the day, you find that the conductivities take the same functional form as this, as the hydrodynamical conductivities that I showed you before. So we get formulae that look like this.
What do you use for delta H?
What? Give me a sec. Next slide. So at this stage, this is just a check that we did our hydro correctly. So it's, you know, not, it doesn't tell us much more information. But what the memory matrix is really good for is that it gives you a formula for omega in terms of some retarded Green's function for some operators. So here I've rewritten it, but you can recognize that this is J phi dot J phi dot. And moreover, if you assume that this Hamiltonian deformation is not too big, so that the current is slowly decaying, then you see that this small epsilon is also appearing in the rate. So this rate is going to be small. This formula is valid, is interesting, whenever it's much, omega is much smaller than other characteristic scales of the system, like the temperature. So what we want to do is, you know, find some nice delta H and compute that width. So now I'm going to do exactly what you asked about. I'm going to find a delta H that does not commute with a superfluid current. So a natural starting point is the realization that the superfluid phase is canonically conjugate with a charge density. And this you can more or less understand by thinking about, first you remember that in a free energy, there's a term that's like mu times rho. And then you remember that by gauge invariance, phi dot is like mu. So the canonical variable to phi is delta f over delta phi dot, which is the same as delta f over delta mu. And that's the charge density. So these things are conjugate variables. And what really this encodes is a Heisenberg uncertainty relation between fluctuations of the phase and fluctuations of the density. So a natural starting point is to think about Coulomb interactions, because these Coulomb interactions would penalize the charge density fluctuations. And by this uncertainty relation, this will enhance the phase fluctuations. A simple choice that, you know, we looked through the literature, we tried a few things, and then we settled down on this term, which is rather natural. So it's just the spatial integral of the density squared. From the effective field theory point of view, it's, you know, a very natural term, because that's the canonical momentum to phi. So it's like a phi dot squared term. So, you know, it's a good idea to start there. And now the only thing we need to do is plug this into our formula there and evaluate that Green's function. So this is what we did. I'm missing a formula. It would have been nice. All right. So at the end of the day, so I didn't put, yeah, there could have been an extra formula I put there. But so at the end of the day, by plugging this in there, and you compute the commutator between this rho squared and J phi, what you'll find is that this omega is related to the retarded density Green's function in the cores, in the vortex cores. So inside the vortex cores, we're going to make an assumption. We're going to make the assumption that the normal fluid in there, that the vortices are sufficiently big, that the normal fluid in there can be treated hydrodynamically. So that's definitely an assumption. If the vortices are too small, then you can't make that assumption. But we're going to make that assumption. And so then you can take the retarded Green's function, the density Green's function, to simply be of diffusion neglect thermoelectric defects as the first pass. And so that's what the Green's function looks like, right? There's a diffusive pole right here, and this diffusion constant is related to the conductivity of the normal fluid and the density-density static susceptibility. So that's, you know, the usual Einstein relations. So then you plug this in there, and you get exactly out the decay rate due to this interaction. So there's a number of numbers in there. You see that it's proportional to, it's inversely proportional to the conductivity of the normal state inside the vortices. It's proportional to the density of free vortices in the sample. It's proportional to the radius squared of the vortices, simply because you're, you know, integrating over the area of the vortex core. And then there's a factor of rho s of the superfluid density. And I didn't write the numbers in the Bardeen-Stephen formula in the previous slide, but these are exactly these numbers. We get the same decay rate on the nodes. But the difference is that this was a classical treatment where, you know, again, you'd write force equations and you balance the forces and you get this out. Whether we got that just by, you know, doing things in a fully quantum treatment. And, you know, I think it's nice because it also allows you to organize a little bit more clearly the discussion in terms of what operators relax, what operators overlap. And so, you know, it's 21st century physics to quote someone else. Yes?
So the assumption is that the vortices are big?
Yeah.
And you also have to set k equal to zero?
Right. There's a limit.
But so really big.
Yeah, if the vortices are microscopic, then, I mean, this wouldn't make any sense, right? But in principle, this formula is exact. So, you know, if you know how to describe the fluid inside the vortices and you give me the form of the Green's function, I can plug it in there and tell you what the rate is. This is the part where you need microscopic input, basically. So the summary so far, before we talk about parity violation. So the objective was to construct a theory of slowly decaying supercurrent due to quantum fluctuations. And we've done this in two ways. First, we did this in a very phenomenological way by thinking about incoherent superfluid hydro and turning on a phase relaxation rate due to the flow of vortices. And we got formulae like this, where indeed we can see that now the conductivity will be sharply peak as long as this width is small compared to temperature. Then we recovered this exact same result by using the memory matrix approach, and moreover, by turning on some on-site Coulomb interaction, we got a formula for this decay rate in terms of the density of the free vortices in the sample and the conductivity of the normal state. So here, this phase relaxation is still intimately connected to vortex physics. So now let's talk about parity violation. So that's important because, you know, as I've stressed in the introduction, all of this physics, the, you know, magnetic fields are always there, so we need to care about magnetic fields. And also, you know, magnetic fields are responsible for the Meissner effect, the pairing of Cooper pairs above the critical field, etc. So you have to, I mean, you can't just not violate parity. And also we saw that in the experiments, this intermediate metallic phase appears when you tune the magnetic field through this transition. Now, in our limit, so this is the incoherent limit, we won't be writing any terms like this, the terms that Diego did not like. So in this sense, I hope he won't scream at me too much, simply because I don't have any momentum. So I can't write these terms. So the only way that the magnetic field would appear is implicitly through, you know, terms in the constitutive relations that violate parity. So let's go very briefly. This is what things look like. It's not as bad as it looks, because the only thing we did compared to before is redefine these coefficients. So these are the same first order coefficients, except I've now rewritten them in terms of density gradients and, you know, entropy density gradients, because that's just easier to deal with in the equations. But so this was the parity invariant part, and the only thing we've done is turn on some epsilon ij's. That's it. So that gives me a bunch of new coefficients. So nothing very special happens here. But more importantly, there's another term that now becomes allowed in the vortex current. It's allowed by symmetry, and it comes in at the same order in derivatives as this term omega. So it's like a new force term. And so we might expect that this is going to have a big effect on the conductivities and on the spectrum. And the equations of motion are still the same. It's still conservation of energy and charge, and Josephson relation is still of this form that I wrote before. Oh, okay. It's too far.
This kind of benefit should also appear in determining the number of vortices.
Yeah, yes, but this would be microscopic input.
Like so this. It just ends up in your NF?
Yeah, exactly. So again, I'll be a little bit more quick about this, but you know, turn the crank and you compute the conductivities, and now you see that something important happened. Instead of having a Judah-type formula, where the pole was just at omega equals minus I capital omega, now this Judah-type pole looks more like a cyclotron pole in magneto-hydro. The old way. And so it's this omega H. So now we've gone to omega as omega H minus I omega. So it has a real part. And because it has a real part, then the optical conductivity doesn't look like it did before. But if you plot it, if you plot this thing, you give some numbers here and you plot this, then you realize that at first, if omega H is small enough compared to omega, then the peak doesn't move off the vertical axis immediately, but it will only do so, so that's what you're seeing here, at strong enough magnetic field, basically. And you know, this resonance is a cyclotron resonance. I mean, it's this guy. So it's really like, you know, usual magnetohydro. Now we can do a bunch of things. We can look at the Nernst signal. So the Nernst signal is the transverse electric field generated by a temperature gradient in the presence of a magnetic field. And this is how you compute it. So you do this matrix multiplication. This is the resistivity matrix. And this is the thermoelectric conductivity matrix. And you take the yx component. And we found this result. And I have to tell you what SV and ρV are, because probably you didn't really see them on this slide that was way too cluttered. So SV and ρV are terms that appear here in the constitutive relation for the vortex current. These terms were not allowed before because they were not compatible with parity invariance. But now that we're evaluating parity, they are. And so this describes the response of the vortex current to a temperature gradient and an electric field. And the fact that this is what shows up in this Nernst coefficient is not too surprising, because you would expect the Nernst coefficient to be sensitive to vortex physics. And that's exactly consistent with, again, one of these older papers on vortex physics. For small omega and omega h, there's another interesting quantity that, I mean, two other interesting quantities that we can calculate. So this, the so-called Lorentz ratios, and this is like the whole Lorentz ratio. And we heard about violations of the Wiedemann-Franz law, etc. So here, so I don't know if you remember from Andy's talk, but, and from, I don't remember if Casey mentioned that as well, but let me go over it again. If momentum is being relaxed and you just look at leading order terms in your conductivities, so you just keep the terms in 1 over gamma, where gamma is the momentum relaxation rate, then you find that this Wiedemann-Franz law is badly violated. It doesn't take the Fermi liquid value, which is this order one number. It gives zero. And here, the exact same thing is happening. These rates, omega and omega h, don't contribute to these numbers. Everything drops out and you just get zero. And of course, if you expanded to higher orders in omega and omega h, then you wouldn't get zero anymore. You'd get something finite. But at leading order, you get zero at very weak phase relaxation. So that was the hydro treatment. And again, we can go through the exercise of rederiving all of that by with the memory matrix. So now things are a little bit more complicated because you have JX, JY, JFIX, JFIY, et cetera, and new matrices are bigger. But still, you can do this. And you can compute, you can relate omega and omega H to memory matrix elements. So here, we see that omega is probably, this should be an X. So this is related to the JX, JX, phi memory matrix element. So that's the same as when parity is not violated. But then omega H now is, you see, it's related to XY components of the memory matrix. And this N here is some static susceptibility. So these are all objects that, in principle, if you're given a microscopic description, if you're given some Green's functions, you can compute. And so in particular, you can go through the same exercises before using this density-density interaction, the rho-squared interaction in the Hamiltonian, and compute the contribution to omega H due to vortex physics. And you see that the same ingredients as before appear. There's the density of free vortices, the radius of the vortex cores, the superfluid density, the static susceptibility for the density. And now there's this new static susceptibility for the density and the curl of the superfluid current. So again, if you know how to compute that, then this gives you some prediction for what omega H is due to vortices. So what you can do is maybe think about different interactions, because this rho squared interaction, it's not intrinsic to parity violation. You'd think that, all right, now that I'm violating parity, I'm allowed a much bigger spectrum of interactions. I can have interactions that violate parity. So let's try to think of one. So the one we thought of, which may or may not be realistic for these 2D superfluid films, but that's not really the point. The point is to give an example, is if you have some emergent Trans-Siemens gauge field, and then you can integrate that out. And the Hamiltonian deformation that this gives you, it looks something like this. So it's this non-local, not very nice-looking thing. But remember that this just comes from some Trans-Siemens emergent gauge field that you've integrated out. And lambda prime is the Trans-Siemens coupling constant. So now what you do is you use this Hamiltonian deformation, and you plug that into the commutator with the superfluid current operator, and you compute the commutator, and then you find that the commutator is proportional to the transverse electrical current.
The Trans-Siemens gauge field couples minimum to your current density?
Yes. It's yeah.
So you have like an anion.
I'm sorry, say that again.
So you have like an anion.
Yes. If you found that exciting, we should talk. All right. And so now that we know how the Hamiltonian deformation, so this is giving us J phi dot, right, if you remember. So now we've computed what J phi dot is. It's given in terms of the transverse electrical current. And we can plug that in our formulae for omega and omega H in terms of memory matrix elements. And what you find is that the rates are related to this sigma naught and sigma naught H guys. So let me remind you what sigma naught and sigma naught H were. Oh, I didn't write them. Okay, so sigma naught and sigma naught H are just the conductivities of the normal component of the system. So, oh yeah, I know where to go. These guys, the guys that don't carry the poles, basically. So this is interesting because you see with the density-density interaction, the rates were given in terms of some parameters that were external to the superfluid, parameters that came from knowing the microscopics inside the vortex cores. But now with this Trans-Siemens interaction, there's no like BKT type input needed. You get the rates in terms of transport coefficients of your unrelaxed superfluid hydro.
That's because your superfluid arc parameter sees the ordinary particles as vortices.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Yes.
And one thing you notice is that... sorry, there's a typo. This should be a lambda prime, no squared. But so you notice that there's a lambda prime squared here and a lambda prime here. So omega is parametrically suppressed compared to omega h. So here, you know, this imaginary part is completely suppressed compared to the real part of the pole. Okay, I'm actually doing better on time than I thought, but good. So let me summarize and conclude and connect back to experiments a little bit. So we've seen how to construct the theory of weak quantum phase relaxation, and we've done that both violating parity or not. And whenever the phase relaxes, we get these sharp peaks in the optical conductivity. So that was one of our motivations, seeing the sharp peaks in some measurements of indium oxide superfluid films. With parity, we've seen that vortices play a prominent role in relaxing the phase, and we've recovered this older formula from Bowden and Steven, but now doing things all at the quantum level. Then we validated parity. We saw that the supercyclotron pole appears. And while I've given you more details about the hydro, because you know perhaps this is more transparent to people in this audience because they've seen, you know, hydro currents and constitutive relations their whole lives. But I wanna emphasize that the memory matrix formalism, it's a more systematic tool to capture the effects of phase relaxation or any long-lived operator, because it's sort of more transparent in terms of what you need to keep, what operators you need to keep. And moreover, it gives you explicit formulae for the decay rates. And this is something that hydro doesn't know about. These decay rates, they're external inputs in your hydro constitutive relations, whereas they just come out of the memory matrix. And I've given you two examples of Hamiltonian deformations, but only these are just the two that we thought of. And for sure, you can think of many more. The almost last comment that I want to make is, what about these zero temperature metallic phases that I started motivating this talk with? You know, yeah, there were these measurements and people were seeing the phase transition between superconductor metal insulator by cranking up the magnetic field. So in itself, what we did doesn't directly contribute to, you know, deciding whether this phase really exists or anything, but we sort of give you, like, through this formulae on the relaxation rate, we give you parameters on which help this to decide whether this T equals zero phase do exist. Because then what you need to know is whether this density of free vortices or the normal the conductivity of the normal component inside the vortex cores or this transport coefficient for the normal component of the superfluid. You need to know what happens to these at zero temperature. And if these things are non-zero at zero temperature, then with this sort of formalism, then that tells you that, yes, there is a way in which, at least from the effective field theory point of view, there's a way in which you can have a zero temperature metallic phase. And the last comment that I want to make is, I sort of didn't emphasize that in the course of the talk when I got there, but what we get when we violate parity is not very satisfying in light of these experiments. Let me flash back to this plot again. Because this is what we got by violating parity and, you know, doing that in sort of a vanilla way. Because the trans-Simons interaction is a bit, you know, it's more specific. There's no reason to anticipate that there's some emergent trans-Simons film in these superfluid indium oxide films. So things will look more like this. But this is clearly not what is seen on these experimental plots. Because this peak is never very sharp, and for strong enough magnetic field, it moves off the vertical axis. So this does not reproduce the indium oxide phenomenology, where it seems like there's some version of particle hole symmetry that's at play, and which is suppressing omega h compared to omega. And so I guess my last comment would be that, you know, particle hole symmetry, when you think about, just forget about the superfluid current, but just put back the momentum, then particle symmetry is the statement that the static susceptibility chi jp, so the overlap between density and momentum, this is equal to the charge density. So particle hole symmetry is the statement that this thing is zero. So that we understand very well. But then in our framework, this would suggest that the corresponding susceptibility to set to zero is the one between J and J phi, since J phi is now the operator that relaxes, except that that doesn't really make any sense, right? That's clearly not what we want to do, because we do want our superfluid current to keep on carrying electric current. So, right, there's something to understand in how we can encode this sort of approximate of emergent, however you want to call it, particle hole symmetry that seems to be at play in these superfluid films. So that's work in progress. And I'll stop here. And thank you for your time.
Just a comment. The Lorentz number there, we do see actually
this guy.
When we see the violation of a Wiedemann Franz law near the charge neutrality point, mm-hmm. after that, actually, when we tune away from it, we actually see it drop below one before it recover to one.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So actually, it's kind of interesting to see. I think Andy's theory also have some similar features. And also, I think Blake, Mike also shows using the diffusion, he also sees something similar.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm not wrong.
Yeah, I think you would, yeah.
So, a question I want to ask you is that this is a superfluid, is it that you're calculating, or? Because what is the kappa here? This is a thermal conductivity for the superfluid? Or?
Yes, that's right.
But if they are really both condensed, how should I think about the thermal conductivity?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
So if it is a superfluid phase,
yes.
The entropy is exponentially goes to zero. So they don't really conduct at all. How should I think about
at zero temperature, you mean?
Yeah, but even if it is under the phase transition, there's not much entropy for the superfluid to have a thermal conductivity.
This is the metal, this is not really the superfluid.
Yeah.
It's not really.
No. We're in this metallic phase.
Oh, okay.
This
okay.
intermediate metallic phase.
So it's a phase after a certain temperature T that you.
Well, you can think about it. Either that, or so the phase after a certain temperature T would be this BKT phase transition. So that's not really what we wanted to think about. This is the, you know, thermal equivalent of what we were doing, in which we went through that transition line, not by tuning temperature, but by tuning some quantum parameter like a magnetic field. So you should think of this as applying to not necessarily zero temperature, but low temperatures and varying the magnetic field.
How sensitive is your agreement with this treatment
part? Balin Steven?
Yeah, this one.
It is.
How sensitive is your agreement on the particular choice of short range density?
So we've only computed it using the density diffusive form for the Green's function. But then. I would assume that the classical treatment that Bardeen and Steven have, you wouldn't really hold if you couldn't write down these classical equations. If you were in a very quantum regime, then.
I'd say if you add some finite range of the interactions in your delta H, does it change?
I think in this large vortex limit, the delta should be more at all. If you have a Coulomb, at an unscrewed form, then you get a failure and it blows up in your face. So you have to, it has to be screened. So,
that's
so
okay.
Yeah, right. But if it's well squared over the vortex, I think in this large vortex limit, it should be screened.
Yeah. They also make this assumption from the start that they're in the limit where the vortex cores are sufficiently large.
Sure. Does your answer for the conductivity of the ion superfluid agree with the calculation they did in the late 80s when the hypothesis of theory came to see?
I don't know. We didn't look at that. Did we look at that?
Yeah, actually, so there's it's a long story. It's not a short. 5 minutes,
right? But do you want to talk? And
you could shut me up and I'd do it. So, but when you're non-relativistic, there are two different transignment interactions that don't have to have the same coefficient. Because so the transignment we write is epsilon mu nu rho, a mu d mu, but it's actually there's a j rho grad rho and there's a rho j dot term. And you really need both of them for this to work because it sort of needs to go into the transignment thing and back. And actually, one of these is turned out to zero, and at least in the papers that we found, they use a different. The transignment.
There's a huge literature on this.
Yeah. As far as we can tell, because this effect would kill superconductivity. But so it looked like they were setting one of these transignments up to zero. But they have a non relativistic transignment term. And it looked like one of them is being set as fit.
Who is they?
Witten,
Wilczek, Halperin, and somebody else.
Yeah, that's right. People probably. Yeah. But we didn't actually find a connection, but there could be one. So it turns out that Trump Simonson was not quite the same Trump Simonson.
How did you get a finite?
Finite? Well, with this transignment interaction, you get zero DC conductivity. I don't know if that's your question.
If you only had one of the two parts, you would get because there would still be the sharp.
Wait, once you turn on the transignment interaction, there's no superfluid delta function.
If you turn on half of it.
What do you mean by half of it?
The thing Sean was saying.
Yeah, okay, that I don't know.
Okay. Other questions? All right, let's think ways again.